raising money since he left office, either through thousands of small donations raised at Trump rallies or online, or via the big donor money machine that Democrats cannot match, being schmoozed by Trump himself on the golf course and in the dining room at Mar-a-Lago. Since Trump founded Save America in November of 2020, the group has raised $124 million, the largest war chest ever built by an ex-president, but spent only about $14 million, or around 11% of the fund. In contrast, the main fund for supporting Senate Republican candidates has spent about 80% of its $135 million it raised since the start of 2021, while its main fund for congressional candidates has spent half of the $162 million it has raised in the same period. The question of Trump's PAC money is beginning to vex strategists on both sides of the political divide. It could be a fund designed to ensure the loyalty of Republican allies forming a new power base within the party. Or he may have other designs, namely securing his own path forward by securing the political future of loyalists. The Democratic consultant Carly Cooperman said it's consistent with Trump's political priorities. Trump first, above everything else, and makes him well-positioned for a presidential run in 2024. Carly Cooperman added, it's possible he decides to make a big splash in competitive races as we get closer to the midterm elections. But above all, Trump's ability to raise large sums of money makes him even more powerful in the Republican Party. According to FEC financial disclosures, Save America spent more than $3 million on events through February, $2 million in consulting services, including to law firms representing witnesses sought by committee investigating the 6th of January Capitol riot, including the Trump aide, Dan Scavino, and Trump spokesperson, Taylor Budowich. It also spent $300,000 on advertisements, $200,000 in contributions to Republican congressional candidates, and at least $170,000 at hotels owned by Donald Trump for lodging, meals, and the renting of hotel facilities. Taylor Budowich, communications director for both Save America and Donald Trump, told Reuters news agency that the former president was supporting candidates through direct contributions, rallies, and joint fundraisers. In other words, efforts that bind candidates to the former president. Taylor Budowich told Reuters news agency, Save America will not be telegraphing specific tactics or expenditures through the press. Every dollar raised will go to ensuring President Trump's America First agenda is advanced through his endorsed candidates and causes. Michael Beckel of Issue One, a nonpartisan group that advocates for campaign finance reform, says, there is a lot of leeway on how the funds are spent. While he remains an unofficial candidate, he can build his brand, draw further attention to himself by hosting large rallies, ostensibly to support other candidates in other states. But every rally has the upside of helping to boost his visibility and his brand. Donald Trump is certainly on the move, holding rallies across the United States with the usual aim of endorsing local supportive politicians. In some ways, it's a substitute for social media blackout. In another, it's Trump's connecting with his base in the way that has served him in the past. Recently, Donald Trump held a rally in South Carolina in support of Russell Fry, a state representative he endorsed to challenge the incumbent Republican Congressman Tom Rice. Russell Fry spoke briefly before handing the podium back to Trump, who continued for 20 minutes. Donald Trump teased, "In 2024, we are going to take back that beautiful White House. I wonder who will do that. I wonder." But the consequences from staying from Trump's agenda are also apparent. Recently, the former president withdrew his endorsement of Mo Brooks for going woke after the Alabama Senate candidate expressed doubt that the 2020 presidential election was a fraud. As Donald Trump withdrew his endorsement, he said, "Mo Brooks of Alabama made a horrible mistake recently when he went woke," and stated, referring to the 2020 presidential election scam, "Put that behind you. Put that behind you." But Trump's enduring influence efforts are not limited to rallies or building his power base. Recently, the website Axios reported that Donald Trump Jr. is planning to launch a mobile news app after the bumpy launch of Truth Social, a Trump-aligned social media network that encourages an open, free, and honest global conversation without discriminating against political ideology. The aggregator site comes with high ambitions to compete with Apple and Google's new aggregators and to supplant the Drudge Report that has lost traffic and influence since founder Matt Drudge undercut the White House message on COVID deaths at the peak of the pandemic. A spokesman said that the news site, MXM, or Minute by Minute, will carry the tag mainstream news without the mainstream bias and would carry news from a variety of publishers across the ideological spectrum. With about 12 employees, an ideologically copacetic news site would be a useful tool, but it is still Trump's money that is the focus of interest when it comes to his future ambitions. Under election finance laws, should Donald Trump decide to run in 2024, he would have to start a new campaign fund. His previous PAC committee, Donald J. Trump for President, since renamed the Make America Great Again PAC, still has more than $6 million in it after raising $13 million in 2021. Beckel explained, "The life of a political action committee after a candidate leaves office can morph to supporting other candidates. The bulk of the money Donald Trump has been raising is for Save America, but he also has a conduit vehicle, so a donor can write one check and is split between buckets according to political contribution limits." Beckel added, "But how Donald Trump will spend the money remains an open question. He could shape the 2022 midterm elections or other future elections significantly if he decides to unleash it. One can predict from how other former presidents or politicians have spent their money, but Donald Trump is not a conventional politician."
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. 19 years ago, a 23-year-old American activist, Rachel Corrie, was crushed to death by Zionist occupation forces. Today, we look back on her murder and ask, what are the lessons that the movement for the decolonization of Palestine can learn from Rachel's story? I'll be speaking to experts about this to find out more after this special report from Bianca Rahimi about Rachel Corrie's murder and the legacy she's left behind.
It is 19 years since Rachel Corrie, a 23-year-old non-violent activist, was crushed to death, murdered by Zionist occupation forces using a Caterpillar bulldozer in Rafah, Gaza. But who was Rachel Corrie? Why was she in Rafah? And what has been her legacy?
I'm here for other children. I'm here because I care. I'm here because children everywhere are suffering and because 40,000 people die each day from hunger. I'm here because those people are mostly children.
Rachel Corey grew up in Olympia in Washington State in the US, famously concerned about the problems of the world. Later inspired by the anti-war movement after 9/11, Rachel was drawn to the issue of Palestine. She arrived in Gaza in 2003. She was murdered in Rafah, defending Palestinian homes from demolition, with her comrades from the International Solidarity Movement, a Palestinian-led activist group dedicated to non-violent, direct action against Zionist forces in the occupied West Bank.
I feel like what I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive, and that is incredibly horrifying.
She gave a filmed interview 2 days before she was killed. 4 eyewitnesses contradicted Zionist military lies that Rachel's was an accidental death. Still, no one was brought to justice even after her parents brought legal action in the US and in Palestine. The last case ended in 2015 with the Supreme Court rejecting the claim for damages in the amount of $1. Rachel was murdered 3 days before the Western invasion of Iraq on the 19th of March 2003. Less than a month later, British ISM member Tom Herndl was shot in the head by a Zionist sniper while trying to protect Palestinian children from Zionist fire. Herndl's murder brought to the end a period of violent assaults on ISM members, which started in April 2002, resulting in 2 deaths and severe injuries for 3 other ISM members. None of the victims got full justice for the crimes committed against them. But Rachel's death galvanized resistance to ethnic cleansing in Palestine. Tributes flowed in from Palestine and around the world. She became an icon of resistance to Zionist ethnic cleansing. Her writings were turned into a play and published in full. The MV Rachel Corey was named in her honor and intended to join the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, but was delayed by mechanical problems possibly caused by sabotage. Eventually, it set sail for Gaza, where it was illegally boarded by Zionist forces in international waters in June 2010. Rachel's parents set up the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice and continue to campaign in support of BDS and Palestinian rights. But what has been the long-term impact? House demolitions have continued, indeed increased, since 2003, according to the United Nations. The Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions estimates that about 52,000 Palestinian homes were demolished in the Nakba and another 56,500 in the territories occupied since 1967. More than 1 million Palestinians have been made homeless as a result of the ongoing crimes against humanity. Today, Palestinians are even forced to demolish their own homes or suffer retribution from the military. But today, the resistance to home demolitions and ongoing ethnic cleansing is picking up pace. The Palestinian people resist the occupier daily, and worldwide revulsion against Zionist crimes continues to grow. We are closer now to the decolonization of Palestine than we have ever been since 2003, and Rachel's sacrifice is one of so many that have got us to this point.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. He's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. We're also joined down the line today from Amsterdam by Evelien Lubbers. Evelien is an independent investigator and one of the founders of Spinwatch. She's also co-founded the Undercover Research Group, and this organisation examines corporate and state spying against activist movements. Her book on corporate state and spies is titled Secret Maneuvers in the Dark, Corporate and Police Spying on Activists. Welcome to the show. David, I wonder if I could start with you. I mean, that was an incredibly moving story about Rachel. I wonder how you would describe her legacy.
Well, she became an icon, didn't she, of resistance, of non-violent resistance against the Zionists. And that galvanized a lot of opposition. You know, as you saw with the naming of the MV Rachel Corey after her and the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, that was all part of the same kind of process of taking protest to the Zionist regime. But of course, the difficulty with it was that the Zionists didn't really care about non-violent direct action. They were perfectly happy to kill and to seriously wound people who were fighting against them. So it's been a kind of, it's a bittersweet legacy, isn't it? Because it did encourage a lot more activism, which has only grown since then. But at the same time, it does bring back the issue of what it is that can finally decolonize Palestine, which I think is not only non-violent direct action.
Mm. I mean, I wonder how you would describe, you know, her impact on the campaign against Zionist settler colonialism.
Well, I think it's made it more visible. It's part of the reason it's become more visible. I mean, she was there before and was killed before, was murdered before the BDS call was put out by Palestinian civil society. And in a way, the whole BDS movement is part of that same trajectory. And we see the BDS movement going now from strength to strength. Yes, it has some reversals and setbacks, but strength to strength and much more widely known, much more widely supported all around the world than it was back in the mid-2000s. So the legacy of the movement is that the movement's much stronger, and that plays into a much greater sense, I think, in Palestine of the impending coming of actual liberation.
Yeah. I mean, Eveline, Rachel Corrie and Tom Herndl have a long tradition of non-violent direct action. I mean, what do you think are the lessons from these tactics?
I think it's a very good way of getting your message across. And I think they have, like, they have been an example of for many people. They are doing what many of us would want to do if we weren't, you know, confined to our jobs and our home. She really went there. And of course, it's very unfortunate that she has become such an example after her death. But I do think that it's very important to continue nonviolent action, of course, in combination with boycotts and maybe sometimes with violating the law from time to time.
Yeah. I mean, David, the you know, the demolitions are continuing, aren't they? Would you suggest that that means that the, you know, the Zionist state has got the upper hand?
It has the upper hand in the sense that it's still in power, as the figures there in the film showed. You know, that's more homes have been demolished since the territories were taken to Gaza, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights were taken in 1967 than were destroyed in the Nakba itself. So this is an ongoing Nakba, which increases in intensity. And we saw last May the resistance against that in Sheikh Jarrah and in Silwan, and the way in which that has itself galvanized world public opinion. So yes, they have state power. They occupy, they are in control. But the control that they have is becoming more tenuous as more and more people see the weakness that there is against united resistance, which is now being demonstrated in Gaza, in the West Bank, and many other places.
I mean, we heard in the film, didn't we, about the fact that we're seeing some Palestinian families now being told to demolish their own homes. I mean, this is adding, obviously, insult to injury. I mean, can you say a bit more about that?
I mean, it's a particularly cruel punishment, isn't it? The people who are effectively refugees, became refugees, and then in 67, when the occupation came, they were, some of them put out of their homes again, and there's an ongoing process of trying to, especially in East Jerusalem, Judaize East Jerusalem. And people are not just evicted from their homes by the fundamentally biased legal system, but they're then required to demolish their own homes within a very short period of time, a matter of hours, or they will be charged tens of thousands of shekels as restitution to the state. I mean, it's extraordinary that they are forced into doing this. Can you imagine having to demolish your own home within 2 days by your own hand, or you would be subject to fines of tens of thousands of pounds? It's just incredible that they would do that. But that's the way in which they operate. I mean, this is something which has only happened recently, and it shows the increasing depravity, essentially, of the Zionist regime.
And it gets, of course, little to no coverage on the mainstream media either, does it? But Eveline, I wonder if we could bring you back. And, I mean, you've got experience of activists challenging to the state and corporate power. I mean, what demands do you think that campaigners should be making in the current context, would you say?
Obviously, that their houses are not being demolished, and instead the house of the Zionists would be demolished, but that is quite obvious. I think it's very important to keep on pressing and to make sure that this is known. As you said just now, this has not been reported on much. And it's such a terrible story. I think it's very important that they get it across in the mainstream media, because it's, well, of course, it's difficult right now with the war going on in Europe now. And everybody, you know, the large audience for them, it's much nearer. And it's difficult to get into the mainstream media at present, but they should keep on trying and prevent. Yeah, it's difficult. You can imagine that they would want to take up arms, but then it would once again get into a state of full war again, and nobody wants that to happen. I guess
before the war in Ukraine. Evelyn, I mean, the mainstream media rarely, if ever, sort of cover these outrages in Israel, don't they? I mean, what should we be doing about that, do you think?
It's difficult. I think it has to do with how you promote your story, and maybe more use independent media and social media to get really good film footage across, because that's the way it works, and make sure that people in the West disseminate it here so that it gets the attention of journalists. That's currently the way it works, apparently.
Yes, I'm sure if more people were aware, there would be greater outrage. But if we could just pause you there for now. We'll come back for a further discussion after this report on how undercover corporate and police agents spied on the campaign to seek justice for Rachel Corrie.
The bulldozer which crushed Rachel Corrie's fragile body was manufactured by the US company Caterpillar. The long-suffering parents of Rachel Corrie sought to bring charges against Caterpillar for their role in the killing of their 23-year-old daughter. However, Caterpillar had other plans and hired the private intelligence company C2I to infiltrate the campaign and spy on Rachel's parents as they struggled for justice. C2I was founded by former helicopter pilot in the British Special Forces, Justin King. His company illegally garnered information about the Corrie's legal strategy and also posed as sympathizers in order to infiltrate the campaign. While Rachel's parents traveled to the Caterpillar offices and asked to meet the chairman, the company refused and was paying C2I to spy on the middle-aged bereaved couple. Rachel's parents even purchased shares in the company so they could have a chance of talking to the board of directors. At the same time C2I was infiltrating the Rachel Corrie campaign, it was being treated as an authority on counter-espionage by the BBC. Justin King solemnly advised the BBC that spies are very easy to find. Sadly, it isn't hard, he said. I'm told the going rate to get a cleaner to steal something for you in London is £20, said Mr. King. Simultaneous to the surveillance of the Rachel Corrie campaign, there was a long-term infiltration of her organisation, the International Solidarity Movement, by the British state in the shape of a spy cop with a fake name, Rob Harrison. Described as the perfect wallflower, Harrison insinuated himself into the ISM and was noted for always offering to drive people places in his car and rarely stating a political opinion. The undercover officer deceived the woman involved in the political campaign into a sexual relationship. It has been said that the undercover officers were permitted or encouraged to form sexual relationships with campaigners they were spying on to obtain information. What is clear is that while much of the world was horrified at the killing of Rachel Corrie and rightly demanded accountability, the British state and Caterpillar went to great lengths to protect the killers.
Evelyn, you've done some groundbreaking research, haven't you, on corporate spying. I wonder if you could tell us how a corporation like Caterpillar would go about infiltrating pro-Palestinian groups.
I think you could say in these days there's two ways of doing it. One in real life, so to say, pretending to be an activist, go to a demonstration or a public event, show interest and hope you get invited to meetings. On the other hand, on the second thing is that, of course, today with online groups and online communication, it's in a way much easier to get yourself on a mailing list of supporters of Corey, for instance, and get yourself into groups that have meetings online and pretend to be an activist, like C2I did in the case of Rachel Corey's parents.
I mean, I wonder whether you could say a little bit about what sort of information C2I would have gathered about the Rachel Corey campaign.
Companies and the police in general want to know, well, companies want to know what is going to happen next. In this case, C2I wanted to know about the campaign against Caterpillar. The company wanted to know what they were up to and what was going to happen so they could prepare themselves and take away the element of surprise if the campaign would sit on their doorstep all at a sudden, for instance. On the other hand, they would want to know who was involved. Names, addresses, background of people, where they lived, and in this case, they found out about the online support group and the online meetings the parents of Rachel Corey were having, and managed to get into it.
I wonder, David, what your take on it?
Yeah, it's a means to try and subvert and undermine activist challenges against the corporation. So the parents there, Rachel Corey's parents, you know, went through the normal way of buying the shares to try and get into the meetings to confront the company. Of course, the company wasn't at all interested in that. It was interested in subverting the campaign against them by finding out intelligence, as Eveline has been saying, but also by what the companies do in this circumstance. They try and destabilize the organization. They put out false information, they leak various things to try and stop the organization having a political effect and to attain its goal. So, yeah, it's a means to try and sabotage democratic pressures on the corporation to deal with the wrongs that they've done.
Mm. Eveline, I wonder if I could just ask you, I mean, is there any overlap between these infiltration and spying activities between the corporate sector and governments?
Yes, indeed, there is. The people that are spied on by the police secret units are usually campaign groups that aim for change, that fight for change, fight against corporations and state corruption. So undermining their campaigns is working for the agenda of the large corporations. Second factor is that the private intelligence companies like C2I often have former police officers specialized in this kind of undermining work on their boards. C2I had at least two former officers who were retired from the police at a relatively young age and then moved on to work for private corporate intelligence companies. So they brought all their knowledge and all their network. They probably have a good access to their former colleagues to get information on the people they're spying on. So it's both in personnel, in network, and in agenda.
Right. I mean, David, I mean, you know, when Caterpillar's nefarious activities were exposed, I mean, how did they react to that?
Well, what that happened in 2017, there was a leak of a cache of documents on C2I and a number of other intelligence operations. And they responded by saying nothing at all. They don't respond to those kinds of allegations. And, of course, we get nothing. So what you see is them just stonewalling, and that's a typical public relations technique. And you've got essentially the police and the corporate spy companies, as Eveline says, working together. I mean, the famous case in London of London Greenpeace, the small organization, which used to meet in a bookstore just near King's Cross Station, where they, McDonald's, who was suing them for libel, had two different sets of spies in the small meetings each time, and also there at the same time was a special branch operative. So the meetings were more or less sort of half made up of spies. Now, that kind of thing indicates that the possibility of not just of the interests that the police are defending being corporate interests, but that they're actually collaborating, these spying operations are actually collaborating. And it's deeply concerning that that would be the case. And we don't have nearly enough information and accountability about that. I mean, one of the things that's happened in the UK is that there's an ongoing public inquiry of the spy cops situation. You know, these undercover police officers didn't just spy on the Palestine Solidarity Movement, but across a whole range, thousands of groups and left-wing groups in this country over the last half century, as Eveline has been saying. And we're getting a little bit of information from that. Eveline in particular has been doing some stunning work on that. But it's really very minor compared to what we really need, which would be to stop this kind of activity altogether.
I mean, Eveline, we've heard some shocking revelations, haven't we, about intimate relations being formed between undercover agents and activists. I mean, would you say in your experience that these sort of intimate relationships are actively encouraged by the people who are controlling these agents?
I'd rather say the women were deceived into relationships, which is closer to the truth. At the official undercover policing inquiry, which is being held now, the officers all claim that they were not told not to do it, and it just happened. If they agree that it happened, they said there weren't any rules. On the other hand, if we compare the experience of the women, there is a pattern. There is it always. The undercover officers always know the women very well. They kind of mirror what they say. They know about their tastes, about their habits. And if they eventually have to leave, they all feign some psychological crisis or some... there's very, very similar stories in their leaving. So that sort of seems to be part of a plan doing that, and they're usually using these women to improve their status within a group. You know, if there would be any suspicions, if you have a relationship with someone within the group or in the just outside the group,
We're going to have to leave it there. I'm sorry to say, Eveline, we're absolutely out of time. But I want to thank you and David for your thoughts today. Very illuminating and interesting. Thank you, everyone. As I say, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, Adam Kinzinger, one of two Republican members on January 6th House Committee, on Sunday, 27th of March, vowed to get to the bottom of events surrounding the 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, but refused to reveal whether the panel intends to question Ginni Thomas, wife of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, over reports of her urging the White House to overturn Donald Trump's election defeat. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Alexander Villarreal. The piece is titled "Republican Won't Say Whether Capitol Attack Panel Will Question Ginni Thomas." The United States, Adam Kinzinger, one of two Republican members on January 6th House Committee on Sunday, 27th of March, vowed to get to the bottom of events surrounding the 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, but refused to reveal whether the panel intends to question Ginni Thomas, wife of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, over reports of her urging the White House to overturn Donald Trump's election defeat. Senior Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar said, "Clarence Thomas must recuse himself from relevant cases," and warned the integrity of the U.S. Supreme Court is at stake. Adam Kinzinger refused to confirm or deny the existence of text messages Ginni Thomas is reported to have exchanged with the then White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, although he did not contest the Washington Post and CBS's joint revelation last week that they obtained copies of such messages from materials submitted to the Congressional Committee by Mark Meadows. The question for the committee in this or any exchange is, was there a conspiracy or how close did we get to overturning the election? He told CBS's Face the Nation program on Sunday. Adam Kinzinger, one of two Republicans on the House Select Committee investigating the events surrounding the 6th of January 2021 insurrection, said of witnesses being summoned to give evidence to the committee. He said, "We'll call in whoever we need to call in." He added, "Was there an effort to overturn the legitimate election of the United States? What was 6th of January in relation to that? And what is the rot in our system that led to that, and does it still exist today? We are going to get to the bottom of this." He did not say whether that rot extended to the nation's highest court, the Supreme Court. Ginni Thomas and her husband are right-wing political darlings who have described themselves as one being, an amalgam, according to the New York Times. Amid the latest reports, Justice Clarence Thomas is now facing calls to recuse himself from any cases surrounding the 2020 presidential election, the insurrection, and potentially the 2024 presidential race, should Donald Trump run for re-election. Meanwhile, Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, chairwoman of the Senate Rules Committee and a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which quizzes nominees for the Supreme Court, demanded that Clarence Thomas be removed from any such cases. "This is unbelievable," Klobuchar told ABC's This Week program. "You have the wife of a sitting Supreme Court justice advocating for an insurrection, advocating for overturning a legal election, to the sitting president's chief of staff. And she also knows this election, these cases are going to come before her husband. This is a textbook case for removing him, recusing him from these decisions." The 29 exchanges reported between Virginia Thomas and Mark Meadows reveal how the wife of one of the land's top jurists disseminated disinformation relating to the QAnon conspiracy theory and other inaccurate arguments during the tempestuous days following the November 2020 presidential election, when right-wingers were claiming Democrat Joe Biden had not won the election. Even as Donald Trump strategized efforts to overturn his defeat through the courts, Virginia Thomas spread false theories, commented on cable news segments, and advocated with urgency and fervor that the president and his team take action to reverse the outcome of the election, the Washington Post reported. It reported she wrote to Mark Meadows, "Help this great president stand firm, Mark. You are the leader with him who is standing for America's constitutional governance at the precipice." The majority knows Joe Biden and the left is attempting the greatest heist of our history. Pressed about how he and his colleagues would broach Thomas's alleged attempts to undermine a legitimate U.S. election, Adam Kinzinger said, "They want to ensure their work is not driven by a political motivation, it's driven by facts." The House Select Committee has so far hesitated to demand cooperation from Ginny Thomas, in part because they're worried she may create a political spectacle to distract from the investigation. Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota said, "All I hear is silence from the Supreme Court right now, and that better change in the coming week because every other federal judge in the country except Supreme Court justices would have guidance from ethics rules that says you've got to recuse. The entire integrity of the court is on the line here."
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
There's trouble in London's police service at New Scotland Yard. They state our vision for the Met is to be the most trusted police service in the world. We contribute to making London the safest global city. We protect its unique reputation as an open and welcoming city. And we want Londoners to be proud of their police. However, a series of damaging cases involving people who have served as London police officers may have undermined the credibility of the Met's ability to sustain the confidence and trust of the general public.
In late 2021, two UK police officers pleaded guilty to sharing photos of the bodies of two murdered sisters at a crime scene they were assigned to protect. In court, officers Dennis Jaffa and Jamie Lewis admitted sharing the images.
"Are you going to apologise for what you did?"
"Today they admitted misconduct.
Other officers have been accused of abandoning an alleged domestic abuse victim in a flat shared with her potentially violent partner, with police allegedly telling her, "There is nothing we can do." Worse still, former police officer Wayne Cousins was convicted of abducting Sarah Everard in a London street as she walked home, then raping and murdering her in a case that has shocked Britain. Her body was found in woodland 80 kilometres away in southeast England. The Everard case has stirred protests over violence against women by the police. The impact of these convictions involving officers has been felt inside and outside the police service. The Metropolitan Police Force, which investigated the murder by Cousins, said it was sickened, angered and devastated by his crimes. Commissioner Cressida Dick apologised, while Labour Party politician Harriet Harman called on Dick to resign, adding, "Women must be able to trust the police, not fear them. Women's confidence in police will have been shattered." Even Prime Minister Boris Johnson added, "Our police are there to protect us, and I know that officers will share in our shock and devastation at the total betrayal of this duty."
How can people who have committed criminal acts of violence pass the recruitment process for a police force? What impact have recent convictions of police officers in London for serious law-breaking offences had on public confidence in the law enforcement services? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. What, in terms of the public's view, constitutes a reasonable standard of behaviour for police officers? We put that to the public here in central London. This is what they told us. Generally, what do you expect in terms of standards of behaviour from any police force? What do you want the police, how do you want them to behave?
I want them to be supportive, but not like judge people based on obviously looks or gender or anything like that. I don't want them to be scary. I don't want to be like they're facing towards me and I become scared of them.
Well, one would hope for high standards, but just lately, probably not.
At least 50% better than they are at the moment.
Yes.
But they have a hard time. Mm. They've got so many things that they're controlled to do, like racial things, abuse of people.
Just to meet the basic, like the citizen needs, like if they need any help with directions, or if you see that they're like in trouble, just to assist, just to help out. If you see someone stealing, but they're stealing like diapers type of thing, then you just like help out, I guess. That's a policeman's job anywhere around the world, I feel like.
Yes.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
You know, not behave in the way that we've seen recently in the news, in terms of we want to be able to trust them.
Yes.
And feel that we're in safe hands.
Yes.
So there needs to be a very strong code of conduct, and if people don't follow that code of conduct, then they need to go. The job's not right for them.
Just like security, like if you ever like, you know, if something ever happened, that you could phone them and they would be there quite quickly.
For them to treat everyone equally, not to treat people different, look different than others. I would expect them to be polite to the public, to look. I think you want to see a police officer and feel that they're safe to approach, and you know, yeah.
I think throughout COVID, it's probably changed a little bit. Less aggressive, to be honest, what I've seen on the news. I know they've got a hard job to do, but I think on the news lately, they haven't been portrayed very well.
And the tourists, they don't know particularly about the people that they can take away their bags or their phones, like me, that I hand my phone. So I expect to protect those people and like to do not leave it like this, like, okay, just leave it happen. It's something that can happen every day.
Good discipline, really. Around, obviously, a lot of presence.
I think just being available for the public when they need them.
Well, I expect them to be respectful and to consider the needs of the people that they're protecting.
I think they should be courteous. They should be there and available for you to speak to.
Two police officers admitted sharing photos of two murdered women in London on a social network. How does the public feel about their actions?
Yeah, that's a different kind of situation there, too, obviously. I mean, as you say, when a police officer, you obviously want your 100% faith in someone, you trust them, don't you, really? And stuff like that, obviously, yeah, there's no excuse, there's no for there, really. You can't excuse that at all.
I think it's horrendous. And what's probably worse is they shared it and other people looked at them and presumably quite enjoyed them, and it's awful.
I think they should get fired. That's definitely confidential, so they shouldn't be sharing that. Yeah.
That's disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. Now, I work for the NHS, and we see some difficult things at work, and it's gross misconduct if you share any information about your patients or any images, and I would expect the police to behave in exactly the same way. And to have a WhatsApp group, you know, it's just terrible.
You wouldn't expect that from police officers. They're meant to be there to, keep you safe. So that just really angers me whenever I hear that, yeah.
At first I've heard of it, but it obviously sounds wrong.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you just inherently think that's wrong just as a person, not a policeman or otherwise. Just as a human, you wouldn't do that, would you?
At the scene of a crime? That's terrible. I don't think any private thing should be taken or shared. It's police material, should not be shared with the public.
I think that's very... very, very bad and very unrespectful towards the woman, but also like the family towards this woman.
I think that's definitely sort of part over the line as such. Definitely not professional and shouldn't happen, really.
I don't know the details of that particular incident, but if that was done without consideration of their privacy or was not part of some kind of formal release of investigation, then I think there's probably some wrongdoing there.
I think it's a boundary that has been crossed. I don't think that that's the right thing to do.
Just not having any clue of the feelings of the families or all people. Like, you know, you're dealing with this traumatic event and you just don't have the compassion to understand how traumatic this is for everyone. If you're taking photos and being a tourist about it, we're kind of losing the point of being a person.
Social media is probably 90% of the problem. And I think anybody that uses that platform to accentuate any crime reveal share is rather disturbed, to be honest.
A London police officer has been jailed for life for raping and murdering a woman called Sarah Everard. How is it that a murderer was able to serve in the police? Here's the public's opinion.
Perhaps, you know, there needs to be tightened regulations or a reevaluation of how, you know, we select the police. Or
they should obviously have to go up against a platform of where there's some kind of, you know, control or procedure that's put in place, like it was in the old days in the United Kingdom.
I guess, like, you never know who the bad guy is until something happens.
It got through the loophole somehow because, you know, I presume they do checks. Something's weren't picked up, so something's gone wrong there. I mean, there are bad people in all walks of society.
Maybe they just didn't do enough background checks on him before he went into the police force. Maybe they need to get more, like, tighter on security checks on who's going into the police.
Well, how would anyone know that someone is going to do that, right? And you can only run a criminal background check on someone if they've been convicted of a crime. So if they've been suspected and weren't indicted on it, you know, like weren't convicted of it, then there's no record of it.
I wonder the same thing. But then also rapists and murderers are also a bit everywhere. It's just sad that they're also in the police force because you think, like, if I want to be police, I'm a good person and should follow the law. And also leads to more, like, scariness because why should I trust the police if they also murder me? And like that.
Yeah, how do they? I wouldn't be best to answer that. I'm sure they get vetted before they start the role, but yeah, it's not nice. But it could happen in any profession, I suppose. But yeah, again, it's you'd expect it not to happen in the police, but these things do happen, unfortunately.
Well, there's obviously a lot of police personnel, so anyone can get in, really. Again, it's down to the individual. I wouldn't say that's them as a whole, and to say it is them as a whole is completely wrong, in my opinion.
It's a very sad news, and I think it puts the entire police on a very bad spot.
Well, I don't think, say, mental illness or those type of issues they have no bounds. It doesn't matter what your career is or how intelligent you are.
I should think the vetting process needs to be more studied and more thorough when they either at recruiting stage or progressively through their life.
Here are the facts. The London Metropolitan Police employs almost 33,000 officers in the front line to try and keep law and order in a city with a population of around 10 million people. Yet, since 2005, 26 Met officers were convicted of sex crimes, 27 of theft, and 72 were convicted of violence against other people. Has public confidence been affected by these latest convictions? A poll in October 2021 revealed 63% of those polled trusted the police in general, but only 33% trusted the Metropolitan Police. In the same poll, 31% said they did not trust the police in general, but that lack of trust rises to 43% for the London Metropolitan Police, meaning that more people distrust the London Met than trust them.
Given all these recent revelations, What level of trust do the people here in London feel able to give their police force?
That's a loaded question.
would you make a call and feel safe, or?
I would make a call. Yeah, I mean, because at the end of the day, you still have to trust that the government is working.
You would go to them, but not perhaps one on his own.
Yes.
You'd want two.
Difficult to say, because I think the Londoners have come to accept it. Visitors, depending on where they come from, might find it strange to have that sort of police force in somewhere like civilized world like the UK.
I think anywhere in the world that stuff happens, like the police and the government's corrupt anywhere.
It's an isolated incident, and I would say 99.9% of police officers are doing the job for the right reason. You can't tar them all with the same brush.
I do still trust the police because that was one person, but yeah, it's just, it makes it quite difficult, you know, to trust them after hearing that.
How many policemen are there in London, policemen or women? I'd say this is a very, very small minority, surely, of the force as a whole, in which case I'd be likely to trust them.
Not really so much trust, because like when I see them or like when they're around the area, I want to feel like, okay, safe, they're here. But if I know that they also do this and that it happens often, of course I don't feel safe around them.
To be honest, not very much. Unfortunately, I have here 2 years, and to be honest, I don't have seen much effort from the police to do their best to protect their people, the residents here.
Just because, you know, that's what you see in the news and the paper, so that's the sort of front face of the police, is the negative stuff. I do think the police do a lot of positive as well that doesn't necessarily get reported on.
Well, the fact that it's, if it's been confirmed that someone like that has been serving in our police, and it, particularly if it's been known for a while and action hasn't been taken, then it reduces our trust.
There's a lot of crime in the police force happening, so I think it's hard to say 100% yes.
Well, I guess you do somewhat not. It does reduce your trust.
You know, you have these kind of incidents all over the world, and I don't think London policing or the police force in the United Kingdom should be held to blame for an incident like that.
Well, that's not fair to lump all the police together, so I think there's still trust in the London police.
Looking at the situation from an international perspective, what image does this police behaviour generate to the wider world about the way law and order is carried out in the capital of the United Kingdom?
I guess you just got to be cautious. It scares people, like, not to be able to trust the police officers.
I mean, I've come to London this weekend, you know, these few days to visit, and I was walking around late last night. I probably feel safer here than I do in my own home, if I'm honest, because there's lots of people around, and, you know, it feels busy and it's well lit.
It did make me quite scared because I lived in London during the pandemic and I heard about that girl getting murdered. So it just makes you think, like, is it good? Is the security here good, you know, in London? And, like, as a girl, do you feel safe walking home at night when you're hearing that? Yeah. So I'd say it just does scare you a bit. Yeah.
Those examples obviously aren't good, but in general, I'd surely say that the police are doing a good job.
I think it scares everybody, really. And I mean, as a tourist myself, I don't really feel so safe walking around here when the police is doing this.
I don't think we should be preaching to any internationally to any country, to be honest. We should look closer to home first before we start preaching out, should I say, so to speak. Yeah.
Well, information now travels very, very fast in nowadays, and you know, immediately everybody will know in the other countries, so, and everybody talks about it, and for sure it can it does damage to the image of the police here in Great Britain. Absolutely.
I definitely think it'll have a negative effect. You know, it's sort of the first impressions, isn't it? If that's sort of the first you hear about British police or English police, and it's a negative story, then that sets it up for the future. And
I think it projects an image that this not being correctly managed at the highest levels, and more needs to be done. And I imagine that other nations looking in would wonder, well, if you're allowing that to happen, what else are you allowing to happen too? And therefore breeding greater distrust overall, not only for our own police services, but perhaps breeding mistrust in other aspects of our public services.
I think that it's sad, and it puts a bad image on the London police.
I think it is a real eye-opener.
It is definitely going to affect because the people coming from other countries are definitely going to think wrongly.
Whether they break the law themselves, they need to be reprimanded, or whether they're carrying out the law, they need to serve and protect with the utmost